Accession number 6024, Reel 1.
Mr. Humphrey, Reel 1. Mr. Humphrey, can we start off with just setting the scene, as it were? Where were you born and brought up?
Well, I was born and brought up in England, and I was born in Sussex. I went to school at a prep school in Worthing. I went to Eastbourne College. From there, I got a scholarship to Oxford and took a degree in mathematics at Oxford.
Yes. Was your family well off, would you say?
No. My father had had a serious injury in the First War, which partially disabled him, and the result was his career was very limited, and no, we were not well off. He was a bank manager.
Mm-hmm. I see. And what sort of scholar were you at school and at university? Did you do well?
Well, I think, although I say it myself, on the whole, I did, yes. I got an open exhibition to Merton College, Oxford, and I eventually got a first in the final honour school of maths there. Then I stayed up, I applied to enter the Malayan Civil Service, and I stayed up, having been selected for that appointment, an extra year at Oxford, learning such things as Mohammedan law, the Malay language, and Oriental customs, all that sort of thing, which was a course that you had to take to enter the service.
At what stage did you decide on the Malayan Civil Service, and why did you make that decision?
Well, my parents would have preferred me to go for the Home Civil Service, but like most young men at that time, I didn't fancy the rest of my life spent in the confines of Whitehall. So I settled on a compromise with them that I would go for the overseas service. For a while, I thought of going to Rhodesia, but the then powers that be at the Colonial Office, the director of recruitment there was a man called Major Furze. He saw me and persuaded me that in view of my sort of academic record, I was far better suited to the Far East, where I suppose they intended to put people who they thought were more academically inclined than the African recruits, where I think perhaps there was rather more emphasis on games ability and that sort of thing, you see.
You've explained why the Home Civil Service didn't greatly attract you. Conversely, why did the Malayan Civil Service seem attractive?
Oh, well, it was well paid in those days. In fact, it was better paid than the Home Civil Service, a situation which got reversed after the war. But in those days, it was a very well paid service. It was a very interesting and life overseas. It was a secure appointment, provided you behaved yourself. And I think most young people in their early 20s, as I was then, I'm not satisfied with the job which keeps them in England. I mean, I wanted to travel and get about and see a bit of the world. And after all, those were the days of empire. At that time, 1932, 33, there was no talk, really, of withdrawal from empire. I mean, India was still the great centre of an Asian empire, so to speak. Oh.
Now, as we get nearer to the outbreak of the war in the East, you received an appointment in 1940 as the resident of Labuan. Exactly what and who came under your control at Labuan?
Well, it was a normal duty post in the Malayan Civil Service, but unusual in the sense that the Malayan Civil Service only had three duty posts outside the Malay Peninsula and Singapore. Two were in Brunei, the British advisor Brunei and an assistant to him. The third was the post of resident Labuan. Labuan was then one of the Strait Settlements, the smallest and, of course, least important from most points of view, the other three being Singapore, Penang and Malacca. But it was a recognised duty post for an officer on his second or third tour of service. It was an island off the northwest coast of the big island of Borneo. It commanded the entrance to Brunei Bay. It had considerable historical significance and had been ceded by the Sultan of Brunei to the first Raja Brooke of Sarawak, or at least to the Queen, but through the intermediary of Raja Brooke, in 1846. So the British had had it as a colony for nearly 100 years.
And what were you in charge of exactly? What was the establishment that you had to take control of?
Well, I was in charge of everything that went on in the island. I was responsible, but I was responsible to the colonial secretary in Singapore and through him to the governor of the Strait Settlements, who at that time was Sir Shenton Thomas. And I had other European staff on the island in of a technical nature. There was a PWD, a Public Works Department man, who was also the harbour master. It was quite an important harbour. There was a customs officer. And then there were other Europeans not in the public service there, most importantly the manager of cable and wireless, because it was quite an important centre of cable and wireless communications. There were underground sea cables from Labuan to Singapore, Hong Kong and North Borneo. And the manager and his assistant manager of cable and wireless were European. Harrison and Crossfields, a very well-known import-export house in the Far East, they had a manager there. And they, in fact, owned or leased, I've forgotten which now, the wharves and all, commercially, for shipping. I didn't have a European police officer. The head of the police there was a very fine Chinese Asiatic inspector, Yeo Kok Ho, who was related to Sir Robert Ho, a very well-known Chinese family in Hong Kong. But he was in the Strait Settlements police, a very fine man, whom I'm very sorry to say the Japanese killed.
When you took up this appointment in Labuan, did there seem to be any immediate danger of an outbreak of war in the East?
Not immediate, no. At that time, I took up the appointment there in December 1940. Even Russia was not in the war. I mean, the war in Europe had got to the stage where the French had capitulated, I think, in July 1940. That had created a very serious situation in the Far East, owing to the Japanese moving in and occupying parts of what was then French Indochina. And obviously that enlarged a threat if the Japanese were going to enter a war against us. And it brought all their military forces very much closer to Singapore. In fact, it knocked 2,500 miles off the distance they had to travel.
But this wasn't an imminent danger in your mind in 1940?
No, the danger in my mind going there was, in fact, the war in Europe and the possibility of such things as German raiders, which had occurred in the First World War, where, in fact, the German cruiser Emden, as is fairly well known, had raided the Cocos Islands in order to destroy the cable station. And so I was far more conscious immediately at that time, December 1940, of being alert against the possibility of a raid by any German naval vessel simply to destroy the cable station.
At what stage did a Japanese attack become a live danger?
It's very hard for me to say because I was told about 6 months later when doing the job that in the event of war in the East, shipping east of Singapore would stop immediately. Well, this was an appalling shock to me because it meant that I had to carry enormous supplies on the island of everything that the inhabitants wanted. There was a population of then of 8,000 or 9,000 people, about 3,000 or 4,000 Chinese, the rest Malays or indigenous races of Borneo. And these people had to be fed, and there were many other requirements too, because the populations round Brunei Bay, including Brunei itself, and the 5th Division of the then state of Sarawak and part of the Western Division of North Borneo, looked to Labuan for supplies by shipping. Mm. And so I immediately had to start devising schemes to carry vast stocks of things against the possibility of shipping stopping.
And instructions for you to do this post-dated your appointment as resident?
Oh, yes, yes. It wasn't until my recollection is we were told to have something like 180 days supply, that being the period required for relief to come to the Far East. But the moment those instructions came, which is my recollection is somewhere about June 1941, that shipping east of Singapore would cease, and that was all I was told. Mm. Naturally, this affected me and anybody east of Singapore very considerably indeed.
Specifically, how did you react to that instruction to build up supplies?
Well, I went to Singapore to discuss matters, actually. It was the only time I left the island when I was there. And I went there for about, I didn't like leaving the place because of this risk of raids or what have you. After all, there was a war on in Europe. But I did, I went off to Singapore for a week and I discussed the matter with the food controller and various people there. As a result of which, it was decided that I would arrange for the construction of warehouses and import as quickly as possible. I think it was about 1,500 tons of rice. And various other things like, you know, cement, nails, you name it, all sorts of things. And also I took, in conjunction with the manager of Cable and Wireless, much more thorough precautions against the cable station being put out of action, and worst of all, myself being captured or anybody else being captured there, or seized there, and forced to transmit false communications on the cable.
Precisely what did you do?
Well, the manager of Cable and Wireless, after consulting with me, got instructions from his company to duplicate all equipment needed for transmitting cable messages. And masses of this stuff arrived, and we concealed it all. He and I were the only persons, well, and the PWD officer, cognizant of this. We took it round in a launch, which I had at my disposal. There was masses of this stuff, that sort of thing. And put it in a house about 7 or 8 miles from the cable station, so that if the cable station was bombed or raided and all the equipment destroyed, the manager assured me he could open up communications within 24 hours again, although not with machinery, it'd be more manual stuff and that sort of thing. Mm. That was all there.
Yes. And the other side of that same coin was how to prevent the Japanese from taking over that communication installation. What did you do in anticipation of that?
I didn't really do anything much about that until after the war with Japan had broken out, because I don't think many people were sure there was going to be war with Japan. I mean, even Churchill, as far as I can see from reading his books, hoped that he would deter them from going to war against us by sending, for example, the Prince of Wales and Repulse there. And my recollection is that negotiations were going on with them up till the very time they struck at Hawaii and Singapore.
Can you mark in your mind what event or what time in Lebuen that all of the dangers came to a head and it really became a positive possibility that a Japanese attack is something you had to prepare for?
Not, I think, really, until it came. It did so happen that after the Prince of Wales and Repulse were sent to Singapore, which was only about a week before the outbreak of war with Japan, the Admiral Sir Tom Phillips, flew ahead of his flagship, the Prince of Wales, and I was suddenly instructed one day by a telegram that some VIPs were coming and would I accommodate them overnight, and they would be proceeding to Manila the next day. I wasn't even told who they were. But when they came, it turned out to be Admiral Sir Tom Phillips with two or three staff officers. I remember one of them was named Captain Harkness, which is an unusual name. I can't remember who the others were. However, they stayed with me in my house. And that evening, which was the night of the 4th/5th of December 1941, after dinner in my house, I asked the Admiral straight out. I said, "Well, sir, is it going to be war with Japan?" Because at that stage, the Japanese envoy, Kurusu, was having discussions in Washington. And he looked me straight in the eye, and after about 2 or 3 seconds said, "I don't think so." Well, whether he said that meaningfully or whether he realised he was talking to a rather young officer. I mean, I was then, just 30, at a very remote post, and we didn't wish to demoralise. I just don't know, but I think he meant it. And the next morning he flew off to Manila. Well, what was it, 5 days later, on December the 10th, he was dead. He went down with the Prince of Wales, and the Japanese had struck Singapore on the night of the 7th, 8th December, according to which side of the international dateline you are.
Now, these preparations you made to neutralising the communications centre in the event of a Japanese attack, how shortly before the attack itself did those events take place?
Oh, as soon as war with Japan broke out. Now, I didn't know of it until 6 hours after they bombed Singapore. Now, the reason for that is curious. I should have had an immediate on-clear telegram, war with any new country. Just three words, war with Japan. That was provided in the defence arrangements. No such telegram came, and the first I heard that we were at war with Japan was when Yokok Ho, my chief of police, rang me up on the morning of, was it the 7th or 8th of December? I get it muddled myself. But at any rate, the morning that they'd bombed Singapore, and said that he had it on his radio that they had bombed Singapore and struck away. And I said, I can't believe it, I said, because I've had no telegram saying war with Japan, which I knew would come at once. And then the manager of Cable and Wireless rang me up and said, I can't get through to Singapore. And I said, what has happened? And he said, I don't know, something's happened the far end of Singapore, the line's destroyed. And we subsequently discovered, because they got the cable operating again within about 6 or 7 hours, and along came my telegram, war with Japan. But Laurie, the manager of Cable and Wireless, subsequently discovered that that very first bombing raid of the Japanese on Singapore had hit the landlines outwards of Cable and Wireless. Extraordinary coincidence. However, I got the telegram 6 hours later, and that very evening I had a meeting at my house with Laurie, the Asiatic Inspector, Kok Ho, and the PWD man and others as to what we should do, as the threat was now obviously immediate. And I didn't know. Mind you, I didn't think Singapore would fall. Even then, the Prince of Wales hadn't been sunk. And I didn't think anybody in the East really thought that Singapore would fall. At least not at that stage. I think one or two had doubts after the sinking of the Prince of Wales and Repulse.
So during the course of your meeting, what decisions were taken?
Well, we decided that the first thing I had to make sure was that I could not destroy any cable, any codes and ciphers and things without sanction, of course, from Singapore, because they were being used the whole time. So I had somehow or another to give myself time to destroy ciphers and codes which shouldn't fall into their hands. We also had large stocks of aviation spirit on the island, which I didn't like the thought of them falling into their hands. And I also wanted to make sure that they couldn't move quickly to the cable station from any point they were likely to land. So among the things we did was the sort of thing you could do in a small place like that. I banned all wheeled vehicles within half a mile of the coast, just like that, so that the Japs, if they landed anywhere, would have to footslog it, whereas I still had a car in which I could move around and get to the cable station anywhere else. It was agreed that we would all, at least two or three of us, would go to the cable station. I arranged a reporting system covering the whole coast of the island so that if anything suspicious happened anywhere visible in daytime, I would be informed.
And how did that system work?
Well, it was largely organised by the police, with people that lived in outlying communities, people whom they felt they could rely on. I also arranged a signalling system with the lighthouses. The likely place where they would land was, of course, the harbours and the jetties, which were on the south side of the island. And navigational lights, which were extinguished, of course, on the outbreak of war, were used by the lighthouses and all for shipping. Well, we arranged with the lighthouse keeper that if he saw anything, he would signal. There was no other means. There was no telephone to the lighthouse, which was on an island or a mile or so away from the harbour. But that was arranged. There was a Eurasian lighthouse keeper there. And we left it at that. But then, two or three days later, after I knew the Japanese had landed at Miri, which is in Sarawak, on the coast just opposite. And in fact, I saw their vessels going down there on the horizon from Nibur, and I reported that to the naval intelligence. I realized that they, you know, it really was imminent then, that they could at any moment they wanted to hop into a ship and grab me. So at that stage, I then started getting rid of all the stores that I had accumulated over the last several months on the island to make sure they didn't get them.
How did you get rid of them?
Well, I gave away nearly all the rice. There was a rationing system in force, and to everybody's delight and surprise, people were just told that on the ration card they could just come and have free about 100 weight and a half of rice, provided they brought their own transport. So, of course, they poured all around the warehouses with bicycles, bullock carts, the lot, and that emptied all except 200 or 300 tons of rice. I sent about 600 or 700 tons over to Borneo, because I thought they might otherwise be short. And then I telegraphed Singapore, because I was very worried about that aviation spirit. There was, I've forgotten, about 150,000 gallons there. I have a record somewhere, but I won't bother to look that up. And the people in Singapore telegraphed back, said, destroy immediately. Well, I consulted with James Henderson, my PWD officer there, and I said, well, how on earth do we destroy this lot? Because it was stacked in a great pyramid in drums in a sort of field within half a mile of the main shopping centre, shops and the town and all that. And James Henson advised me it would be quite dangerous to set fire to that lot, but there was no other means of getting rid of it quickly. Mm. You couldn't break open all the drums or take them out to sea or anything of that sort, except as a very long operation. So I said, well, we set fire to the lot then. So I evacuated the whole town. Everybody was told to get at least 2 or 3 miles clear while this operation went on. And James put a piece of rope, which he soaked in petrol, about 300 or 400 yards long, opened one of these cans and dipped one end in it and put the other end there, and went down with his car and literally just lit the end with a match. Well, the thing shot along this rope, and within 2 or 3 minutes, these drums were blowing up into the sky, I mean, hundreds of feet high. The drainage system was flowing with blazing petrol. Fortunately, it didn't get into the town. It did quite a bit of damage close round those fields, and a whole lot of unfortunate cattle and things got terrified. I don't think any were actually burnt to death, but they disappeared, and it took several days for them to collect all their cows and bullocks and things. And in the middle of it, a Japanese airplane came over to see what was going on, a Japanese military plane. And I just saw it flying round and pushed off again, but that was that. Well, that's in was how we got rid of the aviation spirit. And then I got permission after the Japanese had moved from Miri towards Brunei, because I had fishermen organised to give me information of what was happening over there. I got permission to destroy all the top grade codes and ciphers, which I was terribly nervous about, especially the naval ones, which were bound in lead covers, intended to be thrown overboard, you see, from ships. Well, there's nothing worse to get rid of if you've got them on dry land. So I breathed an enormous sigh of relief when they said you can destroy all the codes and ciphers except the government telegraph code, which was not a very high-grade thing.
What did you do, take them out to sea?
No, burnt them.
Oh.
Burnt them. I ripped them all to bits and burnt them. Yeah. I mean, I tore off the covers, you see, inside the paper. And we had a lot of what were in those days called one-time pads and things, you know, things you used for. Used once and then destroyed. But I had them all, you see, which had they fell into anybody else's hands, gave away an awful lot. It would have been a great deal of use to anybody.
And what did you do about the cable station?
Well, the cable station we just left as it was. But the arrangement we made was that in the event of the Japanese landing, the other Europeans would report to me as long as they could while avoiding capture, and would eventually get off the island. I decided In fact, we agreed, it wasn't really my decision, at a meeting we agreed that I could not leave because we couldn't risk a situation of looting and lawlessness and that sort of thing if everybody just disappeared. It would have been ghastly, I have no doubt whatever, that all the Chinese shop houses would have been looted and all old scores that anybody had against anybody else would have been paid off, a few people knifed and that sort of thing. Well, I mean, one couldn't possibly risk that situation happening. I mean, if it was going to happen at all, let the Japs be responsible for it, but not the British administration. So it was decided that I would stay, and Laurie, who was a very fine man indeed, said in no circumstances would he leave until the cable wasn't wanted any further. And I said, well, the cable will be wanted until they're within 25 yards of it, because I shall report everything I can to Singapore, what strength they're landing or anything else. He said, that's okay. He said, I'll be with you. So he was. But he let his assistant manager go, who was a European, a man with a French wife, a man called Meredith. And so it was arranged that Meredith, James Henderson, and Wixty, the customs officer, and the manager of Harrison Crossfield, a man called Charles Taylor, they would all hop into a car at the cable station the moment that we would all be at the cable station, and the moment the Japs got within 50 or 100 yards of it, and we had a reporting system operating so we knew exactly what their movements would be, they would push off to a point on the north tip of the, near the north tip of the island, where I had a launch loaded with food, supplies, water, even money. And they would try to break and get away via Borneo, and if there were any luck at all, get down to Australia. But I couldn't let Cock Ho go, because I had to have control of the police force. And I couldn't let the medical officer, who was a Chinese, Dr. Kok Bu, go because of possible casualties. As regards your...
Now, to prevent the Japanese from taking over an operational cable centre, what preparations did you make to avoid that?
Well, to stop that, it was arranged that after these people had got away, there would be only Laurie and myself at the cable station, and the assumption was the Japanese coming up the road within a few yards of it. So Laurie then wired the equipment and all at the station itself in such a way that he only had to throw a switch to burn out a whole lot of equipment. I don't even know the technicalities of it. To burn out a whole lot of equipment and render the station inoperable to anybody else, so that the Japs couldn't have caught me or him and forced us to send communications to Singapore, which were giving misinformation. Mm-hmm. That was what I was most nervous of.
Yes.
Well, in fact, it worked eventually just like this, too. I mean, that's what happened.
So you had laid your plans, and the Japanese attack duly took place. Could you describe for me, in as much detail as you can, your personal part in the execution of your plans?
Yes, well, it was the... it was one evening, it was very dark, it must have been the, it was in fact New Year's Day 42. We'd had one or two alarms before then. I mean, curious things had happened. The Japs had in fact sent a plane over which had bombed my house, and which was rather conspicuous. And curiously enough, not bombed the cable station, but they'd also bombed the hospital, which I think they quite generally may have mistaken for some other building of consequence. But as a result of that, I moved out of my house because it wasn't watertight any longer and it wasn't very safe. And I moved into a dental clinic in the town and lived there so as to avoid being hit by what was rather an obvious target. But after all this had happened on the New Year's night, let's say the evening of the 1st of January 1942, after dark, suddenly the signal came from the lighthouse. They could only make three signals. One was enemy vessel approaching, the other was friendly vessel approaching, the other was unidentified vessel approaching. Well, we got the last one, unidentified, but it was enough to make me very suspicious, because any vessel there was known to the lighthouse keeper that was likely to be coming on legitimate business. So our scheme immediately went into operation. I went to the cable station, Laurie went straight away to the cable station. Cock Ho went to his police station and organised all his policemen to run ahead of the Japanese troops to keep us informed of where they were and what they were doing. The police, incidentally, were under instructions in no circumstances to fire on the Japanese. I had cleared that with the Inspector General of Police, a man called Dickinson in Singapore. And I said I thought it would be absolutely ludicrous for this little police force to start firing, however bravely, at an enemy landing, and it was agreed this would be crazy because it would attract fire on the civil population and just make them bomb the place to pieces. So the scheme operated. Ukokpu went there. The others came to the station with reports, and eventually we waited for a long time for James Henderson to come back from the town to tell me what was happening. He had been observing the landing. They landed at the jetty there from motor vessels and things which they'd grabbed in Brunei. And the other three turned up at the cable station, and eventually we decided they should wait no longer for James Henderson, so they pushed off. They raced off in their car to the north end of the island. They in fact got away off the island. They got to North Borneo, and I didn't hear till months later what happened to them. But what did in fact happen to them was they got captured in a launch right the way round off Tawau in Dutch Borneo. They got right round the northern tip. It was really rather bad luck. But they couldn't make it to Australia because the Japs moved so fast into Borneo and there were no shipping or air services working. Had they had a much bigger boat than my rather little small launch, they might have done something better. But they then fell into Japanese hands right round the other end of Borneo.
But, so there you were at the cable station.
We were at the cable station, and then I heard shouting and noise outside. The station was, of course, blacked out, as we all were, against the bombing and that sort of thing. And we heard footsteps arriving, and a police lad, came and said that the Japs are only 100 yards down the road and coming up at the double. They were having to footslog it because they couldn't get any wheeled vehicles. So Laurie then told his Asian assistant, who he had with him, to climb out of a back window and beat it as fast as he could. And